Oh, okay. My name is Tinger. I'm a graduate student from Professor Michael Robbins' group at Johns Hopkins. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for providing me this opportunity to present what I've been doing with my collaborators. I'm going to talk about entanglements and the mechanical failure of polymer glasses. In polymer physics, entanglements refer to the topological constraints that chain-like polymer molecules can't cross each other. It's a very important concept, yet in experiment, it's very hard to directly detect entanglements. However, recent development in computer simulation has allowed us to follow entanglements on a microscopic level. So in this talk, I will apply entanglement analysis algorithms to two different deformation processes in polymer glasses. The first project is about welding of polymers. It's done with Dr. Grest and Professor Parahir. And the other is about craze formation in polymer glasses. It's done with a former student from Mark's group, Rob Hawley, and a group from Greece. The first part of this talk is about thermal welding of polymers. Thermal welding is a common means to join polymer parts together and integrate them into effective device. At high temperature, above the glass transition temperature, if we bring two polymers together, thermal welding allows polymer chains to diffuse across the interface. And as chains get more entangled with those from the opposite side, the interfacial strength develops. And ultimately, the bulk strength is recovered. So we want to understand how does the interfacial strength develops during welding as a function of welding time. And how does this development correlate with the evolution of interfacial structure, in particular entanglements? And I want to point out that in this talk, I will only talk about welding of symmetric, identical polymers. It's essentially a kinetic problem controlled by thermal diffusion. In our simulation, we used a generic coarse-grain bead spring model. Neighboring beads along the chain are connected by the Fini bound potential, which was first used by Kramer and Grest in 1990 in this form. However, this potential does not allow bounds to break. The force and diverges at long bound lengths. For simulations on broken bounds, we switch to breakable bound potential in this quartic form. And then all beads interact by Lerner-Jones potential. To change the entanglement density, or to vary the entanglement bands, we also introduce bound bending potential with a coefficient K-bend. This is a rough mapping to real polymers.
What is your breaking energy, so to speak?
It's on this slide. So in simulation on welding, two polymer thin films were constructed using the standard method. The chain length is 500.
Tape is not stick over here. If he asked any questions.
Maybe you should switch places here.
So the chain length is 500, which is much longer than the corresponding entanglement bands. So we look at well-entangled system. And for simulation on welding, we put two thin films together above TG. And then states at different welding times were quenched to a temperature well below TG for mechanical tests. And for the test, we switch to a breakable bound potential. And more details for the potentials are shown here. This is the conventional Fini bound potential. It diverges at long bound lengths. And for the quartic potential, in contrast, the force reaches its maximum at around 1.3. And that force is about 100 times higher than the corresponding Lerner-Jones breaking force. And after that, the force gradually decreases. And finally, at around 1.5, it's zero. So the atoms initially connected by bounds finally fly apart.
If you would assume that one is room temperature, then it would be a carbon-carbon bond, which is 80 KT at room temperature. So.
And after bounds are broken, we just remove them from a bound list in our simulation. And for the mechanical test, we choose to do simple shear. We froze a top layer of atoms and a bottom layer of atoms, and then move them rigidly in opposite directions at small velocity. And this gives a constant shear strain rate. Although it's larger compared to real experiment, our simulation shows the same weak logarithmic dependence of stress on strain rate.
So if it shears, now it's in a glassy state?
It's in a glassy state, yeah, after quench. And we use the periodic boundary conditions are imposed within the shear plane, and temperature was controlled well below TG using a Langevin thermal state.
Only in the direction perpendicular.
Yeah.
Does that make a difference here? Because compared to the thermal velocity, your shear is extremely slow.
I want you to be careful.
So is this really creep? Or what, how would you describe the response of the material?
Well, you can see it in a minute.
Let's see. So let me move on to show the results from mechanical tests. The plot here is showing the stress versus strain results for states at small welding time. And typically, the stress first increases with shear strain. This is the typical strain hardening behavior in polymer glasses.
But to get to the earlier question, there's also an elastic regime that's basically vertical there.
It's very small.
And then it's yielding. And so it's really in a plastic flow regime, not free.
And the strain is very large. It's far from the linear response region. So after reaching the maximum stress, the peak stress, it starts to drop. This indicates the failure of the weld. And accordingly, if we look at the average interpenetration depths of beads that have diffused into the opposite side, it decreases slowly with the shear strain. And at a strain that corresponds to the peak stress, it drops dramatically. Examination also shows that there were no broken bounds during this process. So these states fail through chain pullout. The strain is localized at the interface. The reason is like this. At steady state, the shear stress is uniform across the interface. But away from the interface, in a well-entangled regime, you have this strain hardening behavior. The stress is higher for the same strain. At the interface, the stress is not high enough to match the high stress. But therefore, the strain is localized near the interface. And we see the pullout there. Note that for these states, the final interpenetration depths and shear stress is almost universal. It corresponds to friction between two polymer pieces after chains are pulled out from the opposite side.
So do you have somewhere a plot there? You plot the strain as a function of z coordinate?
No, I don't have it here. But I have a look at it. The strain is pretty uniform before the peak stress. And afterwards, the strain is localized.
Do you guys have a question? Do you have for comparison a stress strain curve of a perfect sample? So you know what I mean?
Next slide.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Here are the stress strain curves for states at larger welding time and the average bulk response. The perfect sample you mentioned.
Which curve? So
this.
This
one.
Okay. It's the thinner line, right? That's less
in the middle here. This is the average bulk response.
This was in line, okay.
And the response of all the states at later stage collapse onto this average response. And for these states and also for the bulk, the main failure mechanism is chain cision. And here, I'm plotting the percentage of broken bounds as a function of shear strain. And as you can see, the broken bounce increases with shear strain. And also the behavior approaches the average block response with welding time. We examine the distribution of broken bounds. Initially, at larger strain, initially the broken bounds are predominantly distributed around the interface. So this indicates that the interface is still mechanically weak. And later on, the broken bounds spread out. And eventually, you can find them across the whole sample. This is another indication that the bulk response is recovered.
Once you rupture the interface apart, one of the two things should just slide past each other, and there's no reason why anyone should break anymore. Well, I'm not misunderstanding what you're doing there.
No, there are different waiting times, but there are not different times of shear.
This is.
So it's at a fixed volume. And so
these are the welding times.
For different welding time, for different stages.
Sorry. Can you do this with annealing at a higher temperature? What is the characteristic rouse and rotation times for bulk systems of these chain links?
This is the standard fully flexible mainspring model, so the rouse time is a few thousand tau. The disentanglement time is well over 5 billion tau at half a billion high steps. You're not quite in, the bulk polymer is not quite in the diffusion regime. So there's these, right? So a molecule that moves its own size is more like 10 million tau or larger, and significantly larger. So they have not moved their own size by the time you get to the bulk.
So do you see any effect of the interface? Because at the interface you have many loops, so to speak, approaching each other, and then they have difficulties to interpenetrate, like in the metal rings. And we saw this when we looked at the re-entanglement of individually collapsed chains, that this created very peculiar intermediate conformations and time laws for displacements.
Yes, I mean if you
he's about to show some of the configurations and entanglements, and then.
But what he didn't show, which was what we published, Bor and I and Flint published about 2 years ago in EPL, which is if you just look at the interdiffusion, because the ends dominate, the interdiffusion is faster than what you would.
But only for short chains.
Even the 500.
Okay. Maybe 500 is not long enough.
Well, right, infinitely long. I mean, chain length 500, which we did, the interdiffusion is faster than you would predict by rotation. We have to account for the fact that the ends still dominate the cross motion.
May I ask something here? Sir, did you say that the strain happening is somehow related to the time rotation?
You need to have very long entangled chains to see strain hardening.
So if you don't have, you don't see any strain happening?
If you don't have sufficient entanglement, it's very weak.
Well, you see, if you go back to the early time data, if you were to plot the same sort of curve as a function of chain length, okay, the results with increasing chain length would look very much like the results with increasing time. So for very short chain or shorter chains, you would get a little bit of strain hardening, but not much. And that's something that Rob Hoy and I have
looked at. Because for polystyrene, I've seen strain hardening given for the anodizing.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's something, again, you can see it, and it's associated with the degree of orientation. And so, again, that's something Rob Hoy and I have done. Experimentally, I think no one's been able to measure it on unentangled chains because they tend to be brittle.
Can I ask another question? So how many entanglements do you have? So you go from unentangled to fully entangled.
I'm going to show that later. So we use the maximum shear stress, the peak stress, to characterize the interfacial strength. And as an experiment, we plot that as a function g to the 1 force power. And as you can see, before the final saturation, there is a 2^1 force power increase in the intermediate time region. And then after more chain Cijian setting, the maximum shear stress saturates towards the bulk response. And these results agree with experimental results by the lab shear joint method from Richard Wu's group. And as you can see, our simulation setup is similar to their experimental setup. And they look at welding at different temperatures. And for welding at higher temperature, the increase is more rapid. We haven't looked at that, but I would expect the same trend. Now, to understand the power law increase of interfacial strength and the final saturation, we examine the interfacial structure. First, the average interpenetration depth. This inset here is showing the profile for density difference between atoms from two sides. As time increases, the interface widens. And in fact, the average interpenetration depth also increases as T^1 force power. This is consistent with theoretical predictions based on reputation dynamics. The average contour length out of the initial tube across the interface into new tube scales as T^1/2. And the average depth scales as the square root of the contour length, therefore T^1 force power. If we plot the maximum shear stress versus this interfacial width, we can see there is a good correlation before saturation. But there is no saturation in these steps with time. So there got to be something else that determines the saturation. And it turns out that desaturation correlates with formation of entanglements across the interface.
Is that easy to distinguish from the typical fluctuations of the beats? Any of the tube diameter is something like 4, 5 sigma, if I remember correctly.
Sort of sigma what?
So when they approach each other, if you have a lateral freedom, even in the middle of the chain, which is of the order of the tube diameter, and then you have the effect of the ends. And to separate these effects,
he's not separating anything, just measuring the amount of mass that's going across the interface.
But he'll show the actual entanglements next, right. And so that'll be.
So, you know, one set of measurements that's out there that isn't shear are experiments where two dissimilar polymers, but ones where we know what the chi parameter is, so we know what the interface structure in principle looks like, all right? There's been a lot of measurements, particularly with random polymers, looking at the dependence of, for example, the fracture energy, all right, as a function of the width of this interface. I mean, it would seem to me that comparing your results on the time dependence to that might be quite interesting. I can give you a reference to.
We should look at that. And Ting also has done some work on slightly immiscible polymers where it saturates.
Right.
But he won't have time to tell us about that today. So far, it's hard to get too many values of chi and run a billion time steps to weld them. So.
Yeah, we've looked at welding of immiscible polymers, right. Which is determined by kappa, the interface.
But the one of the conclusions there is that, unlike the case where you put a block of polymers in the interface that are long, that everything's dominated by pull-up. Right? Just like what you're seeing here.
So that they're not thick enough to be really entangled.
Right. But the forces can be substantial. Enough to cause crazy, which you're going to talk about next.
So as I said, it turns out that entanglements are very important, crucial for the recovery of bulk strength. We identify entanglements using primitive path analysis. This follows the idea of primitive paths in tube model, what it does is it fixes chain ends and then deactivate interchain excluded volume interaction while retain interchain excluded volume interaction. Then the system energy is minimized by cooling it down to an extremely low temperature. Essentially, this process introduces bound forces along the chain that tries to reduce the bound length to zero and pull chains taut. And here I'm showing the configuration after PBA for state before welding and the state at later stage during welding. And also following Hawley and Grest, we insert extra beads of smaller size into the primitive path network and run another PPA to get thin chain PPA to reduce the effects due to chain thickness. And then the contacts of these primitive paths are identified, and we use them to represent entanglements. So first I'm showing the density profiles for entanglements between chains from the opposite sides. It's normalized by the average bulk entanglement density. As you can see, initially there's no interfacial entanglements, and gradually the amount of interfacial entanglements increase. In fact, if we integrate these curves, we get essentially the aerial density of interfacial entanglements that also increases as t to the 1 force power. And we argue that this is consistent with reputation dynamics. A simple scaling argument goes like this. The total amount of interfacial entanglements scales as the volume into the opposite side. It's the average interpenetration depth times interfacial area. And from this aerial density of interfacial entanglements scales as the average interpenetration depth, and therefore T to the 1 force power. If we plot this maximum shear stress versus aerial density of interfacial entanglements, we see that before saturation, there is a good correlation. But again, there is no saturation in the amount of interfacial entanglements. It turns out that the saturation of interfacial strength at bulk value coincides with the approach of entanglement density to its bulk value. This plot here is showing the density profiles for entanglements between chains from any side. And as you can see here, initially no entanglements at interface, but near the initial free surface, we have two density peaks. This is due to the anisotropic pan-like conformation of chains near the free surface. As diffusion goes on, these anisotropic chains relax to Gaussian chains and diffuse across the interface. So you see the recovery of bulk entanglement density at the interface and the drop of this peak. In the end, the bulk density is recovered across the whole sample, and the bulk response is also recovered. So this is showing the coincidence between these two.
Is the chain conformation is at equilibrium before the initial conformation? So you said that so the entanglement has a peak at the surface.
Yeah.
That even for the equilibrated sample?
Well, the samples were equilibrated in the milk with a free surface for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were then quenched. So to what degree a quenched sample is still in equilibrium is another thing.
But in the milk state, there's a...
The surface is higher than that. Hmm? You're saying that yeah. The entanglement density near the surface,
on the right side, never quenched.
Yeah, but there's one concern that you might have about that. The way that this primitive path analysis is done is to fix the chain ends and then shrink. And so you might worry that there's not any, about anything light at the surface. I mean, I,
right.
And in analysis, we look at the contacts between primitive paths. It's just a representation of entanglements. It might not be appropriate for.
How does this compare to the increased density of chain ends close to the surface?
There is a weak, it's not that strong. There's a 10% or so increase in the, just look at the original starting state. The two films were made when they were welded. There is a little bit more free ends at the surface. Which presumably is why, since they're not fixed in the PPA analysis, that's probably why there's an enhanced peak, which may not be, you know, some other way of doing the primitive path analysis may, reduce that. It's not 8%, that's for sure. It's like a 10% or 7% increase.
Is your how to relax them by distance of your, let's say, half of tube diameter?
We didn't do anything but freeze them. And,
okay. But we did also look at, say, how many entanglements. We did things where we eliminated all the entanglements within some distance from the chain end, just to see how that affected.
That would reduce the peak values, but still there were peaks.
Yes, another question. So you showed that in the shear, as far as the shear yield is concerned, the system has forgotten after a couple million tau that it was initially two films. Have you tried a different loading condition, like uniaxial tension? And
I tried.
And does it, do your conclusions carry over? Has it also forgotten? In the same sense as it's forgetting here?
The problem is that if you try to stretch the sample as you did in craze formation, nucleation of craze might initially be in the region away from interface. So the result is not determined by the interface. Well, it's an average over the whole sample.
But if you go to the very, very late time fracture, I thought there is still some correlation. The problem is that it's hard to make a crack, which we've tried to do. And just to be clear, the problem is that the initial nucleation, it doesn't know that it's short until it's been crazed. And so until the whole region's been crazed, you don't know which parts haven't completely entangled. But then I thought, after the plateau stress, I thought there was a correlation between the peak stress at failure for the craze data and the entanglement time that was very similar to this.
Yeah, after the craze is fully developed across the weld. And if you further stretch it, you can see the correlation between the maximum failure stress and the welding time.
But not before?
Yeah, during the...
Not before, during the...
Because it's not sensitive to that particular interface, only at the very end, okay.
Couldn't you put a small region of your simulation, right, and block chains from going across?
We've tried a variety of creating cracks.
No, and that doesn't work.
It's hard. Maybe we can talk more about that with you all about later.
And
it's frustrating. I mean,
for sure. I mean, it, without a crack, experimentally, we have tremendous problems.
Yes.
You do your trick. Well, and every time I wanted to put that little plate in there to stop it in that region, I got to run some 4 months of to get to another trip.
Anyway, that's a whole long story.
Okay, all right.
I'd like to.
Experimentals are slow.
I'd like to talk to you.
This one game.
So here are the conclusions for this part. We've seen a power law dependence of interfacial shear strength on welding time in agreement with experiment and theory of reputation dynamics. The failure mode, the dominant failure mode for small welding time is chain pullout. For large welding time and for the bulk, it's through chain cesion. And then there is a good correlation between interfacial strength and interfacial structure. Before saturation, the stress correlates with the interpenetration depth and the amount of interfacial entanglements that both increases as T to the 1 force power. But the saturation itself is determined by the approach of the density for all entanglements to the bulk value.
Can you say one more thing, which is how far the chain has to go in, how many entanglements do you need between the two sides to get the bulk?
So like here, for intermediate state, there are some interfacial entanglements. But during shearing, they're easy to be pulled, to be lost by chain end. So we need a sufficient amount of entanglements to recover. And in fact, that sufficient amount is the bulk value. If we only have one or two entanglements, it's not enough to prevent the chain pullout during shearing.
You don't need more than three or four entanglements across, and then you're done.
I haven't looked at the critical number of entanglements needed.
I thought we looked a while ago, and it was like, over two, but not much more than.
That's why I asked the question. You know, it's around three. We did it.
Yeah.
We looked. It's around three-ish, which is surprising.
But one is not certainly right. Not enough. Okay, let me move on to the second part of this talk. It's about evolution of entanglements during craze formation in glassy polymers. So many glassy polymers can fail through crazing under tension. Crazing precedes the crack tip and controls the final crack propagation. It transforms the initial dense undeformed glass into an intricate network of voids and fibrils called craze. And this can happen in a large expanded region, increases the fracture energy of polymer glasses thousands of times, therefore make polymer glasses useful load-bearing materials as window glass or package material. Sufficient amount of entanglements are required for stable craze formation. And theoretical arguments usually associate craze formation with the evolution of the underlying network of entanglements. And these entanglements are assumed as permanent chemical crosslinks. And the tautening of chain segments between them determines the volume expansion ratio of craze, which can be measured as the inverse density ratio between these two states in experiment. And the theoretical argument mathematically goes like this. Before craze formation, you have random walk-like conformation between entanglements along the chain. The n-n distance is about square root of the entanglement length times the persistence length and the length of statistical segment. After craze formation, the chain segment is stretched, is taut. So the n-n distance is about the contour length along the chain. That's the entanglement length times the length of statistical segment. And this formula, based on rheological entanglement lengths, gives good estimate on the expansion ratio of craze. It agrees with experimental results. We want to understand the picture of entanglement evolution during process. Therefore, check the picture involved in this argument. Jorg and Mark has done extensive simulation on craze formation, and here is a typical stress strain curve during crazing. After the nucleation of void or craze, the stress remains constant, and the whole system is steadily transformed into fibrils. When you further stretch this fully developed craze, you get a stress increase for well-entangled system. But in this talk, we focus on this plateau region of craze formation. To simulate craze formation, we use the standard bead spring model with finite bounds. We don't allow bounds to break. And bound bending potential is introduced to change the entanglement length. And we will look at systems with three different stiffness and three different entanglement densities. To simulate crazing, we maintain the simulation block sizes in the XY plane, and then uniaxially stretch the system with constant small velocity along Z direction. And three-dimensional periodic boundary conditions are imposed, and the temperature is again well kept below TG.
May I ask you, how do you know you are in a glass?
Because we've done extensive studies of yield stress and the function of rate and temperature in the past work.
And the time scale of relaxation is the one that collapses. Or what kind of quantity do you?
We actually look at things like viscosity and diffusion and things from above and below, and or just the yield stress. The yield stress tends to go to zero. I mean, this temperature is about a third of the estimated glass transition temperature, so there's no doubt that we're.
What kind of diffusion do you have? When you say diffusion, is diffusion of time?
Well, you can.
Diffusion of glass is not really the equilibrium, it's diffusion zero.
Yes, so you ask when it goes to zero. I mean, when you're trying to figure out, you can use basically this system that people have looked at with many different ways. And it's you might argue between 0.35 and 0.45, but we're at 0.1.
But we can also. Relaxation times in the world as a whole or the parameter defined along the.
Can I ask you, if you go from lambda from 1 to lambda 8, the volume of the system increases by a factor of 8. So you insert like 87% vacuum?
Voice, yeah.
Well, what's in between? Vacuum? Mm-hmm. What's it real like? I mean, for real polymer, what?
Air. And that goes in the interface, which is like.
No, that goes quickly. I mean, isn't there also a time scale for this thing to creep into the following?
Well, yes, you could. Actually, you can prepare tray samples where you can do this flexible, and you can hear the air pushing in and out. I wish I had a sample. I would demo it to you, but I don't have it right here.
So that's not a problem, that's fast.
I mean, if things go very, very rapidly, then there might be, typically the time scale for that thin sample is pretty small.
So it's like with approximation that here come back and say,
yeah.
In
the early experiment, you have a crack and craze. In this, so the difficult thing that the air can move from the crack to the. Yeah, but here, no,
there's
no source of
the. Yeah, so we clearly have vacuum.
Yes.
Okay.
May I ask another thing?
Yeah.
Actually, you didn't answer my question before. So, how many, the longest chain, how many entanglements has?
How many entanglements?
Yes. So, I want to know just if your sample are strongly entangled or just in the crossover region or.
It's about 15.
15 entanglements.
Yeah.
Okay, also for the previous part of the talk.
That's almost 20 if you use the stiffest chain arm.
It's between 8 and 20.
Okay.
Yeah. And for this simulation, we use a different algorithm to identify entanglements. Unlike PPA, which introduces bound force T to pull the chains out. This algorithm imposes strictly geometric operations. It's developed by our collaborators in Greece. So basically, this algorithm randomly choose a local segment and then try to replace it by straight segment. If there is no constraint from other chains, this can be done. Otherwise, you replace it by a kink. So the result configuration, again, is a network of primitive passers. You can identify the context between these PPs and term as topological constraints or TCs and use them to characterize entanglements. And because this is a pure geometric contour reduction algorithm, it preserves better the local structure. We can map TCs to pairs of interchain Bs along the chain and then examine the distribution of them along the chain.
So for example, in the PPA, as the chain shortens, the beads may move a long distance, and so you're not sure where they started out. And then this,
there's some slippage along the chain in PPA, but although the total amount of entanglements is preserved, there is slippage, so local structure is not that well preserved. But here, the perturbation is less. However, the trade-off is computationally expensive. So first, I'm showing that there is no significant change in the total number of TCs. We look at three systems with different stiffness, and in all of them, the total number of TCs varies by less than 3% of the initial value in the undeformed glass. Just for reference, the statistical error of Kreta algorithm is about 0.5 of the total number of TCs. It's because we apply random selection of local segments. Accordingly, the average distance between TCs along the chain changes little as well. Moreover, most of the TCs, about 70% TCs, are between the same chain segments. They're between the same pair of chains and move less than the average chemical spacing along the chain. And this is not due to Kreta, it's because we're stretching the system.
And that's what's shown by the open symbols there.
Yeah, here. As more and more system, more and more atoms enter the crazed region, you see an increase in the percentage of TCs that have changed.
Can I ask you, before you crazed the system, a lot of chain contacts would look like this, and if you pull, then there's a big force. But in the craze now, all the chains are almost parallel, so if there is an entanglement, it's a very low angle entanglement, which can really hold very little force. This is your point. You're pulling in this direction,
you can pull different parts of the chain in this direction.
So well, you could pull this, or you could have this.
You could have that.
And I think all these entanglements become irrelevant as far as the forces are concerned.
We have looked at some of those statistics and how they deviate from an affine deformation, but I think given when we have about 10 minutes left, we can talk about that offline.
Okay, and then we examine the distribution of TCs along the chain, and there's little change in the distribution of this chemical spacing. In fact, the tail of the distribution can be fitted using an exponential function with a characteristic spacing. This characteristic spacing is about the average chemical spacing. It remains almost unchanged. We also found universal behavior for systems with different chain lengths, stiffness, and temperature. When normalized by the average chemical spacing, the distribution can be collapsed onto an universal curve in undeformed glass and in a fully developed craze. So this means that distribution of entanglements is a pure geometric problem, and chemical details or thermodynamic conditions only enter the average chemical spacing or the characteristic spacing. Another point is that this chemical spacing is less than half of the entanglement length determined in rheological measurement. It's because in this determination, a simple random walk argument is assumed. And in this TPL algorithm or CRED algorithm, there is directional correlation between between neighboring PP segments. And in fact, in the stretched, fully developed trays, the orientational correlation between neighboring segments emerge naturally. Now we move on to understand what causes the changes in the 30% initial TCs. They're replaced by new TCs with different chain segments, either between different pairs of chains or between the same pair of chains, but between segments far away from the initial segments. These changes are not predominantly distributed near chain ends, so we can't explain as disentanglement